Hello, citizens abroad. This is Robert De Niro. You're out of the country, but you're still Americans and you still care about democracy. So please show it. Please vote. Americans from many states currently living abroad can still vote in the U.S. election. If you're registered but haven't sent in your ballot, please do it now. It's in your email. If you're not registered, get all the information you need online at votefromabroad.org. Deadlines are close, so don't wait a second. Please return your ballot or find out more at votefromabroad.org. Do it now. Thank you.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, the U.S. had a plan for North Korea to impose sanctions so brutal the country would have to choose between survival or giving up its nuclear program. And he loves Whitney Houston, the Chicago Bulls, and intercontinental ballistic missiles. The 33-year-old dictator who is determined to hold on to that nuclear program. It's Tuesday, September 12th. David Sanger, last week when we talked to you, the United States was talking about imposing the most severe possible form of sanctions on North Korea as punishment for testing a nuclear weapon. Can you remind us what that was all about?
Well, sure, Michael. The North Koreans had done their sixth nuclear test.
We've been reporting all day on North Korea's claim that they have tested a hydrogen bomb.
And they had claimed it was a hydrogen bomb.
Hydrogen bombs have never been used before in warfare. Atomic bombs have. This is what the U.S. dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima back in 1945, ultimately killing more than 200,000 people. But the H-bomb is at least hundreds of times more powerful than the A-bomb.
So this was a big deal because it suggested that they could really make a weapon that could destroy a large city.
But tonight it's the political aftershocks shaking the world.
So the first thing the United States did was they went back to the Security Council at the United Nations and said,
to the members of the Security Council, I must say, enough is enough.
This is the moment to go do the mother of all sanctions.
Washington is proposing the toughest sanctions ever.
They include a ban on all oil and natural gas exports to the country and a freeze on all foreign financial assets of the government.
The original draft of the sanctions circulated by the United States would have shut off all fuel imports to North Korea.
And so what impact would that theoretically have pretty much immediately?
It could have been a great humanitarian disaster. I mean, North Korea's got pretty rough winters, and you could imagine a situation if they actually had cut off all the fuel where people were freezing to death. And for that reason, even some American allies had a hard time with this because you'd be freezing out, you know, North Korean citizens who are suffering under Kim Jong-un.
So the plan here was to basically freeze or starve or force this country into a place where it's on its knees and can't even heat homes and then therefore require a change in its nuclear program.
Well, the theory is that every sanction short of fuel, the Kim regime could pretty well survive. But Kim is completely dependent on the Chinese or almost completely dependent on the Chinese for home heating oil, for all their major fuels. And so the idea was this was his greatest vulnerability. Without fuel, you can't run the country. And if you can't run the country, you can't rule the country.
But the big question is whether China and Russia are actually going to get on board with this. Both of these countries trade oil with North Korea, right?
In fact, China much more than Russia. China's been the supplier of well over 90%. They've got a full pipeline. They would have to basically go over to the pipeline and turn the big red handle and shut it off, as if I was shutting off the water to your house to see if I could make you come out and negotiate a little bit about what you were doing to the neighborhood.
Right. But in my case, I wouldn't be losing as much money as it sounds like China would be losing.
They'd be losing some money. But, you know, if North Korea went away as a trading partner with China, I doubt you'd even see it in the Chinese trade figures.
So if China doesn't derive a tremendous amount of economic benefit from sending oil to North Korea, why won't it just agree to this UN plan?
Because they get a lot of security benefit. North Korea is their buffer between the Chinese border and the American troops in South Korea and the South Korean troops.
So China likes having, however messy a North Korea regime, they like having it there as something that keeps the United States and its ally South Korea as far away as possible from the Chinese border.
That's right.
And what about Russia? Why is Russia dragging its feet on these fuel sanctions?
The Russians increasingly view their role as to oppose the United States on any issue around the world. And while they don't want North Korea to have nuclear weapons either, they would rather be the power broker in the region and feel that this is their opportunity to do so.
So, David, what happened in this week since the U.S. went to the U.N. and said you have to pass this set of sanctions that will cut off fuel? It's essential.
Well, what happened was the U.S. came to the conclusion it was more important to get a unanimous vote out of the Security Council than it was to get exactly the set of sanctions they wanted. So it got watered down. Instead of no oil, the North Koreans are going to get 2 million barrels in the course of each year. So it's very possible that in the end, the North Koreans will decide these are bad sanctions. They really hurt us, but we can live with them.
And David, you said 2 million barrels of oil will now be allowed under this proposal to go into North Korea, presumably from partners like China and Russia. Is that a lot of oil for North Korea?
It's a lot of oil for North Korea. It's not a lot of oil for almost anybody else. Mm-hmm. And it's less oil, we think, than they've been bringing in, probably by at least a third. But it's not going to have the kind of instant effect that just shutting off the oil might.
Sounds like it's enough oil to keep the economy operating.
Yes.
David, thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Michael.
On Monday evening, the United Nations Security Council voted for the watered-down sanctions against North Korea, which are still stronger than the sanctions imposed by the UN a month ago, but significantly short of what the Trump administration had demanded just days ago, before negotiations with China and Russia. After the break, the 33-year-old leader of North Korea, whose nuclear ambitions got us to this point. We'll be right back.
How can a microchip manufacturer keep track of 250 million control points at once?
How can technology behind animated movies help enterprises reimagine their future?
Built for Change listeners know those answers and more. I'm Elise Hu.
And I'm Josh Klein. We're the hosts of Built for Change, a podcast from Accenture.
We talk to leaders of the world's biggest companies to hear how they've reinvented their business to create industry-shifting impact.
And how you can, too.
New episodes are coming soon, so check out Built for Change wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Shane Goldmacher. I'm a national political correspondent for The New York Times, covering the 2024 election. I have off and on for years covered the role of money in politics, and that means sifting through tens of thousands of line items in campaign reports, looking at who's getting paid, how much they're getting paid, who's donating these campaigns, who's reserved the most ads on Google, who's this billionaire changing the shape of the race with a single check. Look, the campaign spin, the strategists tell you one thing, the numbers don't really lie, and those numbers help us ask the right questions. That's what's so special about the New York Times. We get to tap the collective knowledge and wisdom of my colleagues who have expertise in every nook and cranny of this country and this campaign trail to tell you the full story of what's happening in these critical moments in the last few weeks of the election. If this kind of coverage is important to you, you can support it by subscribing to the New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Che Sang-hung, you've been reporting on Kim Jong-un going back to the very beginning. So let's start there. Can you describe his childhood?
I think we should start with his father, Kim Jong-il, who ruled North Korea from 1994 to 2011. His mother's name is Go Young-hee, and she was quite famous singer and dancer in North Korea. and the youngest son is Jong-un. But the North Korean regime is famous for its secrecy, so we don't know many details about what he was like as a child. But we do have some details, mainly from the Japanese sushi chef who used to work for the Kim family in Pyongyang.
So we know most of what we know from a chef who made sushi for the leader and his family.
Yes, he is the main source.
That's kind of amazing.
And according to the Japanese sushi chef, Kim Jong-un spent his childhood in a life unimaginable for the rest of North Koreans. Jet ski and expensive sneakers, gourmet food imported especially for the family. But he spent at least several years in Switzerland, going to public schools there. According to his classmates in Switzerland, Kim Jong-un was a very normal kid. His passion was actually American basketball. And Michael Jordan is his hero. His room was plastered with the NBA posters and pictures of Michael Jordan and other famous Chicago Bulls. And according to one of his classmates, Kim Jong-un liked Western music, like Michael Jackson, Whitney Houston.
Whitney Houston?
You know the song called Brother Louie by a German musician? That song was Kim Jong-un's favorite song. And this classmate said that Kim Jong-un listened to national anthem very often.
Wow. So Whitney Houston, German pop, and North Korea's national anthem. That's Kim Jong-un's youthful playlist.
Apparently, yeah.
So Kim Jong-un finishes his schooling in Switzerland, and his father, Kim Jong-il, is still in power back in North Korea. What's his father's rule look like at this point?
So he is the leader who is best known for the famine in the late 1990s.
While the dear leader, as he became known, is said to have indulged in his appetite for the finer things, his people were literally starving to death.
And according to some estimates, more than 2 million people were killed.
Jeez.
The country was completely shut off and isolated.
So amid all of this turmoil at home, how did Kim Jong-un come to be the heir to his father's regime? How did he actually take power?
His father had a stroke in 2008, and he disappeared from public view for many months. And there's a lot of speculation who is going to succeed him. In a typical Korean family, it is the eldest son who inherits the father's title. But apparently his father favored the youngest son, Jong-un, from early age, thinking of him as his successor.
Why was it him, this younger son, not the firstborn, who took over?
Yeah, so there was three sons, and the eldest son, Kim Jong-nam, made a critical mistake.
He was caught sneaking into Japan with a false passport, wanting to visit Tokyo's Disneyland.
Was seen as a huge embarrassment.
Why is that such a big mistake, and why is that so embarrassing?
Well, the son of North Korean leadership is traveling with a fake passport, and also he's trying to enter Japan, which is supposed to be one of the biggest enemies of North Korea. Whatever little chance Kim Jong-nam may have had until then to become his father's successor, he just wasted it.
What about the middle son? Why didn't he become the leader?
Yes. So we don't know what disqualified him as a future leader, but Kim Jong-un's father called him too girlish to be a leader.
So you said too girlish, too effeminate.
Yeah.
So one son gets disqualified because he tries to get into Tokyo with a fake passport to go to Disneyland. The other son is disqualified because he is considered too effeminate. And that leaves this third son, Kim Jong-un.
Yeah.
This is probably the most militarized state on earth. And now, heading its repressive regime, a new supreme leader. Kim Jong-un grinned and chatted as he reviewed his...
And how old is he when he becomes the leader of North Korea?
He was 27 years old.
Wow, very young.
전략 로켓군 장병들과 조선인민 내무군 장병들.
What did people expect from this 27-year-old new leader of the country? What were the expectations?
A lot of people were saying that he would become a figurehead manipulated by his uncle, Jang Seung-taek. And Jang Seung-taek had been one of the most powerful officials under Kim Jong-un's father.
Mm-hmm.
But then suddenly, in late 2013, Kim Jong-un had him arrested and he was executed.
Why did he do that?
Just a very long list of accusations against him, including clapping his hands half-heartedly when Kim Jong-un entered a party meeting.
So not clapping enthusiastically enough.
Yes. Basically, he was accused of not showing enough loyalty to his young nephew. And then...
South Korean intelligence reports several recent executions of top North Korean officials under the regime of
Kim Jong-un ordered the executions of 340 people so far, including 140 senior government officials since coming to power in December.
In Kim Jong-un's workers' utopia, General Hyun was apparently killed or pulverized by anti-aircraft fire.
Wait, I mean, how do you kill someone with a gun designed to destroy a plane?
North Korea ideology calls for extreme hatred toward the enemy. Some serious anti-state criminals are executed with the anti-aircraft guns to eviscerate the body.
I can't even fathom that.
And more shockingly, many elite members are required to witness the executions of these people. That was designed to instill fear into the elites.
And I imagine it's pretty effective.
Yes.
So how is he seen within his own country, within North Korea?
Yeah, unlike his father, who was best remembered for the famine, Kim Jong-un is being portrayed as a people-loving leader. And he's young and youthful, and he always smiles. And he visits nurseries to hold babies.
Sounds like a politician.
Yeah. And his wife used to be a quite well-known singer, celebrity.
Like his mother.
Like his mother, yes. She's something of a fashion trendsetter, carrying expensive handbags, designer suits. But when you talk about Kim Jong-un, every analyst points this thing out. He looks exactly like his grandfather.
Hmm.
His grandfather, Kim Il-sung, was founding president of North Korea, and he's a godlike figure. If North Korea is church, he is God and Jesus Christ.
So does the fact that he looks like his grandfather, is that accidental, or is it something he deliberately tries to do?
Both, I think. He imitated his grandfather's short hairstyle, and the way his grandfather holds cigarettes, the way he gesticulates, and he actually deliberately gained weight to imitate his grandfather's stocky beard.
Wow.
And apparently he has overdone it. He's, as you can see, he's overweight.
So how has Kim Jong-un handled North Korea's nuclear weapons program compared to his predecessors?
Kim Jong-un's father was kind of a little ambivalent about his country's nuclear weapons program. But Kim Jong-un is very different. He is very determined to launch nuclear missiles against the United States. So he's very single-mindedly focused on making his country a nuclear power.
How does Kim Jong-un justify pursuing these nuclear weapons to his people when doing so results in these punishing sanctions that cripple the economy and make it harder for people there to live day to day? How does he do that?
Well, according to North Korean propaganda, the Americans are about to invade North Korea anytime, and his long-range missiles keeps the American enemy at bay. And the whole system is based upon fear and loathing the Americans. For example, North Korean children, during the school field day, the school teachers establish a large American GI effigy just like a mannequin, and let children throw rocks and, you know, mark grenade toward the American GI, beating it with the sticks. And that is the main propaganda brainwashing that goes on daily in North Korea.
Wow. Sang-hun, help me understand what Kim Jong-un's ultimate goal is here. He's stockpiling missiles. He's making extraordinary threats. What is he after?
The general assumption is that North Korea wanted to go the way Pakistan and India have gone. They pursue nuclear weapons despite international community's protests and sanctions. But eventually, those countries made themselves recognized as nuclear powers.
Hmm.
And that's exactly what North Korea is trying to achieve.
And those countries, Pakistan and India, ultimately become countries with relationships with the rest of the world.
Yes. That is the long-term goal for Kim Jong-un.
So what you're saying is that this Western-educated student who spent time in Switzerland and then came home to North Korea to become a murderous dictator who is reviled around the Western world might actually become the leader who eventually integrates North Korea back into that Western world.
Yeah, I guess that is what he actually is trying to achieve for himself and his country. But given the way he's confronting United States, and given the way he's threatening the world with his nuclear and the weapons, it seems to be a very far-fetched goal as of now.
Sang-hun, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you.
Here's what else you need to know today.
I've just gotten an alert from Associated Press. The first ever tropical storm warning, first ever, has just been issued for Atlanta, Georgia.
Charleston, South Carolina, getting hit very hard by Irma.
Literally waves upon waves. This looks like Tybee Island right now. As River Street is literally a beach. We're seeing
Hurricane Irma, downgraded to a tropical storm, swept into Georgia and South Carolina on Monday, flooding neighborhoods in Charleston and Savannah. As the storm left Florida, the depth of the damage was revealed there. Five dead. 6 million people without power.
Trees down, we've got power lines down.
And 180,000 staying in shelters.
The water is not working, the sewer is not working, and there's no electricity. So it's very tough.
Governor Rick Scott traveled across the Florida Keys on Monday, the low-lying islands that were hardest hit by the storm.
My heart goes out to the people in the Keys. I mean, there's devastation, and, you know, I just hope everybody survived. It's horrible what we saw. I know for our entire state, but especially for the Keys, it's going to be a long road. There's a lot of damage.
That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.